10 years ago, Friday, October 27th, 2006, Lori and I were visiting our friends Mike and Dee Riley in Oregon. Mike was then the football coach at Oregon State University. Mike's team had been a little disappointing. There were high hopes for this team that would be pretty good. But at this point, halfway through the season, a little more than halfway through, they'd won 3 games and lost 4. They had a losing record. People were expecting better. There was a lot of unhappiness. And unfortunately for them, their prospects for immediate improvement were not good at all, because the next day, they were going to have to play the USC Trojans, the undefeated USC Trojans. Undefeated as in they had not lost a regular season game in more than 3 years. Poor Oregon State was an underdog, to say the least. No one gave them a chance in the game. The night before, Oregon State had a chapel service in which the speaker recounted the familiar story of David and Goliath. And he used it to encourage the players to trust in God in their lives in all situations, but also to play the next day without fear as they faced the college football giant. One of the players really took the lesson to heart. He went out and he found a little small stone and he put it in his sock the next day and played the game with that stone in his sock to remind him of David. After that chapel service, there was a team snack time, and Lori and I were there for both the service and the snack time. And I was sitting at a table with Mike, and we were talking about the upcoming game the next day. And we were talking about the challenge that USC presented and all the various aspects of their team. And I was asking, well, how, you know, what do you do, Mike? How do you attack that team? And we talked about that. And as I talked, I got the impression more and more that this was a hopeless enterprise. So finally, I just said, Mike, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? And he said, without a moment's hesitation, with remarkable conviction, I think we're going to beat them. I thought, and you're crazy. Actually, I thought, well, that's just another example of Mike's characteristically positive, upbeat spirit. That's just how he is. But I thought he was going to be severely disappointed. And the next day, his team battled toe-to-toe with that football giant. They gave everything they had some, and it was a thrilling game. It was decided in the final 7 seconds of the game. And at the end of the game, final score was Oregon State 33, USC 31. David had beaten Goliath again. The story of David and Goliath is so familiar that it's become part of our culture. It is now the standard analogy for a hopeless underdog facing an enemy that is overwhelmingly powerful. And it is a story that we love to hear. And there's a reason why, which I'll allude to later. We want the underdog to win. But this story is more than an underdog story. It has a powerful message that sometimes it's easy for us to miss. Yeah, the underdog, for sure, and that's an uplifting story, but there's a little bit more to it than that. So let's look at 1 Samuel 17, the story of David facing off against Goliath. The Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Socah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill, the Israelites another, with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, or are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man. Have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, then we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's three oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward, and every morning and evening he took his stand. And we'll skip down to verse 26. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Well, they repeated to him what they had been saying, told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can I even speak?" Well, then he turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he's been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it." Might be a little exaggeration there, the seizing by the hair, but anyway, you get the idea. "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear, will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Well, okay, go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him, a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened his sword on over the tunic, tried walking around because he wasn't used to them. I can't go in these," he said to Saul. "I'm not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of a shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was a little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome. He despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog? You come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give you your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." As the Philistine moved closer to him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran over, stood over him, took hold of the Philistine's sword, drew it from the sheath, and after he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Shaaraim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Philistines returned from chasing the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. Okay, first thing that we can see here is that Goliath really intimidated God's people. Philistines, their camp, they were constantly raiding Israel, and this here they are out invading again. They get to a place where you've got the Philistines camped on high ground in one place and the Israelites camped on high ground in the other. And neither's really willing to abandon their strong position and attack the other on their ground and put themselves at a disadvantage. So you have a stare down. The Philistines come up with a plan that they think will break the stalemate. They send out their most fierce and intimidating warrior, who challenged Israel to send out a best man to fight single combat. This is the very first known form of UFC, minus the cage and referee. This wasn't unknown. Actually, in the ancient East, it was more familiar farther to the west, but the Philistines actually were a seafaring people that had migrated in the previous 200 years from the west, this area, so probably brought the practice with them. The interesting thing about it is that typically when this happened, the idea was it'd save a lot of lives because it was just one guy that was going to die, but it almost never worked that way because the armies almost always fought afterwards anyway. Now, I can't prove this, but I'm pretty sure that the whole point of this was intimidation. I think the Philistines were pretty sure that the Israelites didn't have anybody that could match up with Goliath. And their hope was that Israel would be either so cowed by the Philistine champion that they would just quit the field altogether, or that they would essentially have already lost the battle when it started because they were so afraid. Now, it's not hard to understand why they might have thought that. Goliath, a name synonymous now with being enormous and powerful, maybe even undefeatable, was a huge man. Interesting side note here in Jerusalem Report, Jerusalem Post reported in 2005 that Aaron Meyer, who was the head of archaeology at Bar Ilan University, discovered a ceramic shard at the site of the ancient Philistine city of Gath that had the name Goliath written on it. And it was dated to 1000 BC, just about 50 years from the time of these events, possibly. Which suggests that the name Goliath probably was a fairly common name among the Philistines. But this Goliath was not common. The text tells us that he stood 6 cubits in a span. That works out to 9.5 feet tall. Now, there's some debate about that. There are some ancient texts that say he stood 4 cubits in a span, which would work out to 6 feet 9 inches. Which of them is correct? Well, it's hard to know. Doesn't really make too much difference, because at that point, the average Israeli man stood less than 5 feet 6 inches tall. So Goliath would have towered over the tallest of Israelis by more than a foot. Not only was he huge, even if we take the smaller number, and by the way, I don't know have you ever been around people that are that tall? Just after I graduated from college, I got to know a guy who had played basketball at UCLA. His name was Ralph Drollinger. Some of you might remember him. 7 feet tall. And it was the weirdest experience when you would stand there and talk to him. I'm not used to, as a grown man, talking to people like this, you know. Hi, Ralph, how's the weather up there? He made me feel like a little kid. He's just that, you know, he's way up there. That's how Goliath was. But also, we're told that he had this armor that he wore, 5,000 shekels. That works out to 125 pounds of bronze armor. This guy was able to walk around and fight wearing 125 pounds of armor. In other words, not only was he tall, he was big and he was strong. This dude was huge. You know, Seattle Seahawks had a running back. He just retired, named Marshawn Lynch. His nickname was the Beast. And when he started running, this guy was big, fast, powerful. He just ran through people. I mean, he just run them over. And they called his running Beast Mode. Man, when Beast Mode gets going, you just want to get out of the way because he's going to hurt you if you try to tackle him. Well, Goliath was the real Beast Mode. Because when it came to Goliath, there was nobody like him. And with Goliath, it wasn't just a game. To quote Vasily from the movie The Princess Bride, with Goliath, you fought him, death was on the line. Verse 11 says, on hearing the Philistines' words as he taunted them, Saul, the king, and everyone else was terrified. In fact, later on in verse 24, it says that they all fled from him in great fear. So every morning for 40 days, Goliath will come out and shout his challenge, and all of Israel would turn and run. David saved the day. Enter David. At this point, He's nothing but the youngest brother in his family of eight boys. Three of his older brothers are in the army with Saul. They're in the front lines being intimidated by Goliath day after day. David's too young to be a part of the army. He's sent by his dad to bring supplies to the brother. When he arrives, he observes what's happening, and he's disgusted by it. Everyone is looking for a rock to hide behind, but David is outraged. He says in verse 26, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? He's not saying, oh, what's this guy's name? You know, he doesn't know. He's saying, who is this dirty Philistine? He thinks he can defy God himself. Just asking the question is a rebuke to everybody else. All the soldiers are cowering, and David's going, how can you let this happen? This guy's defying God. He asks what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine, and just asking, he's essentially saying, I can do it. Now, you know that David's brothers are going to be irked by their brash little brother. You know, it's really easy for David to come and talk big because he's not going to be put in danger. Nobody expects him to take on beast mode. You know, he's a little kid that's fighting acne. He doesn't fight beast mode, you know. And now the little imp is in the front lines criticizing them. Verse 28 tells you all you need to know about how they felt about David. I know how conceited and wicked you are. Whoa, conceited and wicked? David's response is the classic younger brother's lament, isn't it? Now what have I done, you know? Can I even talk? You know, he's used to the poor little brother always getting dumped on by the older brothers. No matter what he says, he's always wrong. He's the one who's too young. His opinion doesn't count. He's the one who's told when he speaks up, children should be seen and not heard. Been there, done that, you know? Anyway, apparently what David said was reported to Saul, and so Saul has him brought to him. And Saul's really hopeful. Oh, there's somebody here who says he can take on the beast mode? That's great, because, you know, it's been more than a month. Nobody's willing to do it. And then David shows up, and it's a kid. And his heart sinks. You know, David's saying, let nobody lose heart here. I'll take this guy on. And Saul thought that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I'm sure he thought David had a lot of heart, but he was pretty sure that Goliath was going to cut that heart out if David went up against him. So Saul essentially responded, look, there's no way that's happening, kid. You know, there's just no points in this battle for losing bravely. So forget about it. But David says, you know, I've been out with the sheep. I fought a bear. I fought a lion. I killed them both. This guy's no worse than a bear or a lion. Let me at him. Saul's desperate. He doesn't have any other answers. So he says, okay. It's your funeral. Go ahead. David, you know, they try to outfit him with armor. He can't handle it. He says, nah, don't need that stuff. So he takes his little rocks, puts them in his bag, and walks out there carrying his staff, his shepherd's staff. Beast mode sees him and just laughs. Who do you think you are, you little wimp? You come at me with a bunch of sticks. Come here, I'm going to give your flesh to the animals. You know, if I were in David's shoes or sandals, I would have been shaking at that point. Here's this intimidating, massive human being, scowling, armored up, and he's trash-talking like crazy. David didn't even flinch. Verse 45, he says, you come against me with sword, spear, javelin. I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty. This day, the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll cut your head off with the sword. That's some world-class taunting, you know? Amazing. David's heart is revealed by what he said in verse 47. All those gathered here will know that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. The battle is the Lord's. That's what David cared about, and that's what he believed. So David puts his rock in his sling, begins whirling it as Goliath approaches. And ancient Middle Eastern shepherds were known to be amazingly good with the sling. They could whirl the thing around 6 times a second. That's how fast they would whirl it. And they let that thing fly. The rock would come out faster than a major league pitcher can throw a rock. David's aim was true. He nails Goliath right in the forehead, and the big man goes down. He's dead. Game over. Underdog wins. Yeah. Don't you love that? Oh, man. The Philistines were certain that no one could ever stand up to beast mode. They thought that big guy could intimidate Israel and they would run away. And up to that day, they'd been exactly right. That's what had happened every single day. But that day, the Philistine strategy worked exactly in reverse. The Philistines watch as this kid comes out and took out Goliath, and they were shocked to their core. This was the first and briefest shock and awe campaign in history. They can't believe what they've just seen. They're thinking the Israelites are so unintimidated by Goliath, they didn't even bother to send a soldier out there. They sent some kid out there, and he took Goliath out in seconds. If a kid can do that, what can their soldiers do? Let's get out of here. They turn, they run, and the Israelites pursue them all the way to the fortress of Gath. What an appropriate passage for Father's Day. You know, if most of us men were totally honest with ourselves, with others, we'd admit that we feel like we're kind of overmatched in this world. We're asked to do more than we have it in us to do. What a fearsome fight we have. Yeah, we're the David. The great news is David won the battle, and so can we. All of us, men and women, are going to have to fight the Goliaths in our lives. We're all going to face them. We have our fears that we have to face intimidating enemies. You know, it may be a person or some people. It may be some situation in life. Maybe it's even our situation in our culture. As we look at what's going on in our culture and the direction it's taking, and we think, you know, it's amazing how things are changing. Writer and UC Berkeley law professor Philip Johnson says that the overwhelming majority of people who are in the highest positions of authority in our government, in media, in education, in the courts, do not believe in God and want there to be no place for even the presence or mention of God in our society, and they're working to that end. And we have to face that. It's a Goliath. It's a battle that we all face. There's some things that we can learn from David that are more than just, yeah, David sometimes wins. There are some things that we can learn about how he responded that are important for us as we respond to the Goliaths in our lives. And the first one is this: David did not fight Goliath on his terms. David didn't fight on Goliath's terms. Writer Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book a couple of years ago titled David and Goliath. And his thesis was that David wasn't actually as much of an underdog as he is typically assumed to be. He claims that it is likely that Goliath actually suffered from a medical condition that's called acromegaly, that was responsible for his great height. And that medical condition actually came with some side effects, one of them being vision problems. Sometimes double vision or sometimes extreme nearsightedness. And so he claims that Goliath, though he was big, really couldn't see his opponent. So that's one problem. The other thing that he claims is that David's ability with the sling really pretty much could be equated with artillery in today's military. He said that he believes that the stopping power of that stone was basically the same as a 45 caliber bullet. And so if that's true, then the David and Goliath story is actually the story of the giant bringing a sword to a gunfight. You know, it's kind of like that scene. Remember the scene in the Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indiana Jones is in this street and this intimidating guy all dressed in black comes out with a saber and he's flourishing the saber, you know, I'm going to chop your head off. And Jones kind of looks at him, shrugs, and pulls out a pistol and goes, bam, down he goes. Well, Gladwell says that's what happened with David and Goliath. In terms of sheer size and strength, yeah, David was a big-time underdog, but he upended his underdog status by using unexpected tactics that flipped the odds in his favor. That's his contention, Gladwell's. Now, I believe he's on to something, but he has overstated his case. First of all, the stone and the sling aren't close to a .45 caliber bullet. They're good. You can dodge a stone. You can't dodge a bullet. Secondly, the evidence for a medical condition and poor vision for Goliath is flimsy at best and actually is quite unlikely. Just a little bit of thought can reveal the problem with it, and that is that how intimidating a fighter is Goliath going to be if he can't see his opponent? He's not going to beat anybody if he's out there kind of going, just go around behind him and hit him on the head and you're all done, you know? So probably not accurate. And furthermore, the sling and the stone, maybe not that much of an advantage for David. We know that because if you consider the context, we can know that this incident didn't revolutionize warfare. You know, after this incident, Saul didn't put David in charge of the new first sling division for the Israeli army that could, you know, we're going to wipe out those guys before they even get close to us. Didn't happen. Why not? Well, because they all knew this was a one in a million shot. This was just, you know, this was one of those deals. There's a one of the David and Goliath moments in sports history was in 1980 U.S. Olympics. Hockey, the U.S. hockey team going against the vaunted, seemingly undefeatable Soviet team. In his speech before that game, Herb Brooks told his team, if we play them 10 times, they'll beat us 9 out of 10. But not this game. That's what happened when David fought Goliath. Everybody knew, if David fights him 99 times or 100 times using that sling and that stone, he's going to lose 99. But not this time. And that was the only time that counted. Now, having said that, Gladwell is on to something. And he's on to the fact that had David said, okay, I'm going to go out there with a sword and a shield and armor and fight Goliath, he'd have lost. He couldn't fight Goliath on his own terms, on Goliath's own terms. So David fought him on his terms, using the weapons that he was familiar with, and that's an important lesson for us. It's interesting, there's a man named Ivan Aragon Toft. He's from Harvard. He's written a book titled How the Weak Win Wars, and he studied the last 200 years of military history. And he's identified in those 200 years many conflicts when a weak opponent faced a much stronger, overwhelmingly stronger opponent. And he discovered that when the weaker opponent uses unconventional strategies and tactics that play to their strengths and to the weaknesses of the stronger opponent, they won in 2/3 of those wars. The weaker won 2/3 of the time. Gladwell gave an example of that principle at work in a much less dire situation. There's a man named Vivek Ranadive, came to this country from India, started a high-tech company called Tibco that's been tremendously successful, so successful that he now is the owner of the Sacramento Kings NBA team. But his introduction to basketball was kind of interesting. It happened when his daughter was 12 years old, Anjali is her name. She decided she wanted to play basketball. They lived in the Silicon Valley. So she joined a basketball team. They were lacking a coach, and there were on this team of girls, there were only two that were really serious basketball players. The rest of them had never played. Ranadive says they were a bunch of little blonde girls from Silicon Valley. And he himself had never played basketball, but he said, well, I need to help, so he said, I'll coach the team. Now, he always thought it was odd. He'd seen basketball and thought that basketball teams do something odd, and that is that they make a basket, And then they run down to their end of the court. They concede three quarters of the court to the other team. And he said, he watched that and he said, that's crazy. That's like a football team, you know, scoring a touchdown, kicking off and letting the other team advance unopposed to your own 30-yard line. Why would you do that? So he said, okay, we've got this team. Our girls aren't tall. They don't shoot very well. Actually, they can't shoot at all. They don't dribble very well. So what can we do? Because we're going to be fighting against, playing against teams that are much more talented, bigger, talented kids. He said, here's what we can do. We can defend. And so we will defend every inch of the court. From the time the game starts until the very end, we are going to defend every moment of every game. And we're going to use superior conditioning and tenacious, ferocious defense as our weapon. And that's what they did. And they defeated team after team that was far more talented because under the intense pressure of their defense, these teams would just fall apart. These little girls start throwing the ball away and they panic. And parents would get upset and say, you can't do that. Well, it's in the rules. What's the problem here? He had parents challenging him to a fight after the game because they were so upset because they saw their little girls that were supposed to be so good just falling apart. They used the one thing that they could do instead of trying to fight the other team on their terms. Here's the thing. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 and 4 says this. Though we live in the world, we do not wage war the way the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. Paul says, we're out there facing the world. We're facing Goliath. We try to use the weapons of the world to fight the world, we're going to lose. We don't do that. We use different weapons. Okay, what weapons are we going to use? Well, let's start with, what are the weapons the world uses? As I was thinking about this passage, I thought about an incident I had several years ago where we had a little problem with a company that we do business with, you know, a contract with, and they did some shenanigans that cost us a bunch of money, and I was upset because they weren't treating us fairly. And so I called them and I said, you know, look at what you've done here. This isn't right. Here's why. It's, you know, and they just said, too bad. Their weapon was just power. You know, we're stronger than you. This is the deal. You got to come to us. You got to pay. You got to do it the way we say. Well, my reaction was I started thinking about, what can I do? What power can I use to fight back? You know, could I take them to small claims court? I'll lose there, you know, because they got lawyers will come and they'll do stuff. You know what? So I thought, okay, I can just tell them, well, okay, I can't defeat you, but I'm going to let everybody know how you've treated us. And oh, by the way, I'm a pastor and I have the ears of lots of people. And I'm going to tell them all how you've treated us. You know what I was doing? I was saying, I've got to use power to defeat them. They're using power. That's the way we do it. That's power. I'm going to be stronger than you. It's a weapon of the world trying to defeat the world. And Christians have typically done that. You know, we look at sometimes at our culture and what's going on in the world, and we see some of the things happen in our culture, and we think, we got to get power. We got to exercise our power and make them. You know what? We're using the weapons of the world to try to defeat the world. We're playing on their ground. Here's the message we need to get very clearly in our minds. If we try to defeat Goliath by using Goliath's weapons, we're going to lose, and we'll lose big. We don't use the weapons of the world. Well, okay. We can never defeat Goliath by using Goliath's weapons. What weapons do we use? Well, okay, here's an interesting thing. David, in some ways, is kind of a foreshadowing. He was Israel's greatest king in ancient times. He is a foreshadowing in some ways of the greatest king Israel ever will have, and that's Messiah, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ came into this world and he faced the power structures of this world in his life. The most powerful people in the world arrayed against him. The most powerful people in his nation opposed him. The most powerful people in the world, Rome, opposed him. How did he respond? So here's the first question we need to ask. Did Jesus have enough raw power to defeat those opponents? Yes, he did. He had power over nature itself. You know, when he stood in the night he was arrested before the chief priest of Israel, the most powerful man in his country, was he at that man's mercy? No, not at all. When he stood that before Pilate, who said, you know, I have the power of life or death over you, Jesus responded, said, no, you don't. Get out of here. You don't scare me. What did Jesus do? Here's how he fought. He went to the cross and he died. Well, that looks like a loss to me. It looks like it, but it turned out to be the greatest victory in the history of the human race, in the history of creation, the greatest victory ever. Why did Jesus die on a cross? It's because he loved. And his desire to love people, including the ones that put him on the cross, he said, I will serve you. I will do what is necessary to provide you with what is your greatest need, which is forgiveness and eternal life. And I'll die to do it. And those were the weapons that he used. He used the weapons of love and service, forgiveness and grace and sacrificing himself. And those are the weapons with which we fight today. They are weapons of divine power. You know, you have to ask, which of those weapons were the most powerful? Well, you know, it would be easy to say, oh, you know, Rome's weapons, they were the most powerful. They were control things. Yeah, where's Rome today? Gone. How about the chief priest? He died and his whole clan basically died out. How about Jesus? Well, he's alive and his followers constitute the greatest, largest movement on the face of the earth. Which was more powerful? Was the weapons Jesus wielded. So when we fight our world, when we fight those Goliaths in our life, we need to immediately go to saying, I am tempted always to fight on their terms, to fight against them the way they're fighting me. And every time we do it, we lose. Oh, we might win a battle, but we lose the war. But every time we say, I'm going to fight with weapons of divine power. I'm going to love and I'm going to give grace and I'm going to forgive and I'm going to sacrifice myself. We might even lose a battle, but we win the war. Now, there's one other weapon that's really important, and that's the weapon of faith. But I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. So let's start with that. We don't fight Goliath with Goliath's weapons. We use divine powerful weapons, divinely powerful weapons. Second thing that we need to notice here that we can learn from is that David lived for the glory of God. And 1 Samuel 17:26, when he witnessed Goliath taunting, David was upset over the disgrace to their almighty God. And his whole message in this passage is everybody's going to know when this day is over that the battle isn't to the strong, the battle isn't to the biggest guy, the battle is to the Lord, because our God is the God who reigns. And that's what I care about. You know, everybody else in Israel pretty much believed what David did. They believed in God. And they wanted God to be honored. But not if they had to die to prove it, you know. I want God to be honored, but fight him? I don't think so. Which means on their order of priorities, it's like, okay, priority number one, preserve self. Priority number two, honor God. For David, priority number one, honor God. Priority number two, probably other things than preserve self. Preserve self was on the list, but down the ways. Psalm 34, verses 1 through 3, David said, I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. I will glory in the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. That's what David lived for. That's why our Bible is full of songs that he wrote. Because he lived to glorify God. The thing he said matters to him more than anything else is that God be honored. If I have to go down and fight Goliath, and even if he kills me, as long as God is honored, I don't care, that's fine. So what I care about is that God be honored. So there's a pretty simple question that comes into play for all of us. What matters to you most? What's at the top of that list of things? These are the things that I will never compromise on, that I will do always. Is it to honor God? You know, our little granddaughter, Ella, she is just cute. I mean, amazingly cute. Sweet, happy baby. One of the things that disturbs me about her is that she is fascinated already at 6 months old by cell phones. Oh, man, get out a smartphone and she just, oh, I want it. It, you know, you can put her down on the floor and on her tummy so she can work on, you know, getting stronger. And you can just put a cell phone out there, a little out of her reach. And she tries to figure out, how can I get, I got to get it, you know. And you can try to distract her. You can say, look over here. Hey, Ella, here, I've got another toy. Look at this. And she ignores all of it. The only thing that matters is smartphone, smartphone. Now, I'm a little disturbed about what that may mean down the road for her, but the illustration is, what if we were like that with saying, glorify God, honor God, none of this other stuff, I don't care about that. You know, yeah, it's nice if I can do this or that, but what I care about, honor God. I'm totally fixed on that. So that if life hands me lemons, I don't make lemonade, I make praise to God. You know, I don't care what happens. What I care about is that whatever happens, I honor God. You know what? If we have that attitude, the attitude that David had, we are going to be so strong and powerful, it will blow people away, just like it did with David. But one last thing. David trusted God. You know what? David, he's being told, you're nuts. You want to go out there and fight. You're just a kid. And he says, hey, you know what? The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistines. I'm not worried about him. He's able to stand there and say to that guy, talk all you want, man, 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 Goliath, but here's the thing. You're going to die today. God's going to take care of you through me. Total trust in God. Well, yeah, but that was something that happened 3,000 years ago. You know, we're living in today's world. Nah, it doesn't work. And same God David had is the God that we believe in. Hebrews 13:5 says, God has promised, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. He claims he would never leave us to muddle through on our own. We think, well, that's nice that he's there, but I don't see him. And can he do anything in this world? In verse 6, he goes on. The writer of Hebrews says, so we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. Believe that? God is with me, he's my helper, I'm not going to be afraid, because he is as ever-present and as powerful today in my life as he was in David's life the day he faced off against beast mode. Ephesians 1:11 says that God works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. He works out everything. He's involved in everything that happens. And we can trust him in every single thing. You know, People are magnetically drawn to the underdog. A big part of the popularity of March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament in March, is that everybody's always excited to see the underdog defeat the overwhelming favorite. Something about the underdog appeals to us, doesn't it? I admit, something deep within me emotionally, I realize I'm a little bit sappy, sentimental these days, but I still get emotionally touched when Daniel wins the match at the end of Karate Kid, you know? I still get teary-eyed when the Titans win the championship game and remember the Titans, and when Rudy finally gets into a game at Notre Dame and Rudy, and when James Braddock defeats the champion Max Baer and Cinderella Man, on and on, every single time, it's like, yeah, I love that. I love that stuff. Why do we like the underdog so much? It's because we identify with him. That's me. We all feel like we're the underdog. I've been going through life, and there are these powerful forces arrayed against me, and I'm the one who looks like I'm going to lose. Here's the great news. As followers of Jesus Christ, we're no more an underdog than David was that day. Not because, as Malcolm Gladwell said, he had superior tactics and weapons, but because he was walking with his God and he was dedicated to the honor and glory of his God. And when we do that and we trust in our Lord, we can win the battle. We will win the battle every single time. The battle is the Lord's, not mine. It's up to me, my ability, my tactics, my cleverness, gonna lose. Not up to me. All I need to do is be faithful to my God. The battle is the Lord's. Gladys Staines is a missionary to India. She and her husband went to India to minister to lepers, of all things. They ministered there for a number of years, many years. And then they were attacked by Hindu extremists. Her husband and her son were killed, burned to death by Hindu extremists. It's terrible. The perpetrators were arrested, and Gladys came out and said an amazing thing. She said, "I want them to know that I forgive them and that I love them. What they've done is terrible, and it's been a crushing for me, but I want them to know that in the grace of Jesus Christ, I forgive them and love them." In 2005, she was awarded the Padma Shri by the government of India. It's the highest award given to a civilian in India. She appeared to lose the battle, but she fought with the weapons of divine power, and as a result, she won the war and her God was honored. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this great underdog story. Every time I read it, it just picks up my heart. David won when he should have lost. When everybody thought he was going to lose, he won. But he didn't win because he was smarter, stronger, better. By his own words, he won because he walked with you, he was dedicated to you, and he lived as you called him to live. So Father, all of us, as we sit here, each one can think of the Goliaths, the beast modes in our own lives that we all face. Sometimes we feel intimidated by them. We don't have what it takes to defeat them in the world's terms. Help us, Lord, to remember not to fight with the world's weapons, but to look to you, to trust in you, and to, above all, seek to glorify you in everything we are and do. And we know if we will do that, we will win the war. You will win the war because the battle belongs to you, Father. Amen.